Welcome to the MIR podcast. I'm Kathy Posey, a director at MIR.
And I'm Ariana Yupi, senior project officer at MIR. Each episode, we talk with people around the world who help us to see how climate change intersects with everyday life.
Today, we're talking about Brazil, the Amazon rainforest, its people, and its global significance in the climate story.
Our guest is someone who has spent years reporting from the intersection of environment, health, and human rights.
Joining us is Monica Piccinini, a Brazilian journalist and writer whose work has appeared in The Ecologist, Open Democracy, and Truth Dig. She's covered the Amazon, indigenous rights, pesticide policy, and Brazil's environmental politics.
Monica, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me to this CERN podcast. Really happy to be here talking about Brazil.
Thank you, Monica. You've written for many international outlets about Brazil and the Amazon. Could you tell us a little about your journey? How did you move from general reporting into environmental journalism?
Sure. Most people don't know how I ended up in environmental journalism. It started in 2020 during the pandemic when Jair Bolsonaro was in power. Watching what was happening from abroad was quite painful. There were so many deaths that were completely avoidable because of a denialistic government. And at the same time, environmental protections were being dismantled at an alarming rate. So I reached a point where just watching the news wasn't enough anymore. So I basically contacted an independent news outlet called Byline Times and asked if I could write about Brazil. So at that moment, I had literally never written an article in my life. So one of the founders was incredibly generous and gave me a chance to write about a piece about Bolsonaro. They liked the piece and then published the article and many other pieces after that. And that's how it all started. Then I began writing on for my own blog and contributing to other news outlets. And the main thing behind it all, it's passion. I developed a deep passion for the Amazon. And I also realized that there was a gap in information about the region. So I felt it was important to fill in this gap. So this is the story behind it.
Thank you. Yes, I'm sure passion is key and it's what makes your articles so engaging. You have covered both the scientific and human sides, from farm workers to indigenous communities. How do you balance those stories?
Yes, most of the topics I cover are about projects that often impact indigenous and traditional communities, as well as small-scale farmers, which are the ones who really put food on the plates of the Brazilian population, really. So the large-scale farmers are part of an industrialized system focused on export, and they usually tend to benefit from all these projects.
Speaking about the Amazon has been back in the spotlight recently for fires, deforestation, and now reforestation pledges. From your perspective, what's the real situation on the ground right now?
Yes, the list is long. So let's start with something simple. The Amazon isn't just Brazil's problem, okay? We all know it regulates rainfall across South America. It stabilizes the global climate. It stores vast amounts of carbon. If it reaches a tipping point, the consequences will not stop at Brazil's borders, literally. They will affect food systems, water security, migration, health, and economic stability, not just in Brazil, but globally. So now here's the uncomfortable part. Researchers show that at least 38% of the northeastern Amazon and 30% of the southeastern portion have already been deforested. So scientists warn that anything above 20% deforestation risks triggering a tipping point. And we are already far beyond that threshold in those key areas. Some parts of the region have registered temperature increases of between 2 and 2.2 degrees Celsius, which is really high. So when we hear political speeches about protection and leadership, We need to measure them against all these numbers. About Brazil's president, Lula, and his environmental image versus the reality. International, Lula continues to present himself as a climate leader, but on the ground, he supports most of the major infrastructure and extraction projects currently advancing in the Amazon. And let's be clear, Brazil is legally obligated under its own constitution and under ILO Convention 169, which Brazil is a signatory, to ensure free, prior, and informed consent from indigenous peoples. Okay? But consultation doesn't mean informing people after decisions are made. It means they must have the power to veto these projects, to say no. And that power is rarely respected. Okay? And something else that's quite intriguing, Brazil is also facing a water crisis, believe it or not. The country holds 12% of the world's fresh water reserves. The Amazon basin is the largest freshwater system on Earth, and the Cerrado contains about 80% of Brazil's water basins, and yet Brazil is entering a water crisis. For you to have an idea, the Cerrado covers roughly a quarter of the country, and half of it has already been destroyed. You know, deforestation, industrial agriculture for export, mining, pesticide pollution, fires, climate change, and drying out water systems. And all of this is bringing drier soils and reducing, you know, the groundwater recharge from the, you know, the aquifers. So fewer trees are weakening the flying rivers. The flying rivers is the moisture that brings rainfall across the entire South America. So for you to have an idea, in 2024, the Amazon recorded its highest carbon emissions on record due to fires. And most of these fires are not natural. They are deliberately set to clear land for cattle ranching and agribusiness. And this is, here's something that rarely, rarely gets discussed. Brazil treats emissions from Amazon fires as net zero in its official carbon accounting, okay? Even though fires are the largest source of carbon emissions in the region right now. And there's something else we can't avoid talking about, shared responsibility, okay? This is a bit tricky. I spoke to a scientist from Brazil's National Institute for Space Research, INPE, just last week. And she mentioned that blaming Brazil alone is quite hypocritical. And I do have to agree with her. You know, the US, European countries, China, the UK, and many other nations, they all buy soy, beef, timber, minerals, and commodities linked to deforestation. So we do have to admit that there's a global complicity here, right? Another issue I'd like to mention is a bill called the Devastation Bill. The Devastation Bill introduces a self-licensing system, which is quite damaging. Companies can now obtain environmental permits by filling out online forms. Can you imagine? Environmental impact assessments can be bypassed. So previously, the licensing process could take from about 6 to 7 years. Now it won't take more than 12 months. And that makes it so much easier to approve all the projects, such as dams, highways, oil and gas projects, and mining operations. And one of the major beneficiaries of this bill is the reconstruction of the BR-319 highway. And I have written extensively about it. It's an 885 kilometer highway connecting the capital of Amazonas to Manaus to Porto Velho. So this highway cuts through one of the most intact regions in the world. And this road would impact 69 indigenous territories and around 18,000 indigenous people, okay? And they have not been properly consulted. This highway isn't about connecting communities, like all the politicians say, oh, we need to connect, you know, communities to the rest of Brazil. No, it is about facilitating the flow of natural resources. And agribusiness will benefit enormously from this highway, including cattle farming. Like companies like JBS, the world's largest beef producer, would benefit from this road, accelerating deforestation. JBS, as we know, is owned by two brothers, the Batista brothers, and they've been accused of deforestation, slave labor, corruption, and pollution. And Lula, the president, is extremely close to them, which, is quite inflammatory, I think. Meanwhile, indigenous rights are being violated. The Marco Temporal, or Time Frame Bill, is a legislation backed by agribusiness lobby. Okay, they are called the ruralistas in Brazil, and it means that indigenous people can only claim land they physically occupied on the 5th of October 1988, the date when Brazil's constitution came into force. So according to this law, there's no history, none whatsoever, prior to October 1988. So what happened before is not relevant, okay? And it's just outrageous, right? It goes on, the list goes on, if I may be able to go
Yeah, go
forward.
ahead. Yeah.
We can't forget about the soy moratorium, okay? This is a 2006 agreement that stopped companies buying soy grown on newly cleared Amazon land. So this is being weakened and will lead to more deforestation and more conflicts. So can you see the pattern here? All the pledges to mitigate climate change and to protect the indigenous and traditional communities are just empty promises, okay? And there's a final thing, something else I need to mention on the top of all of this. It's oil production. Brazil is also expanding oil production. The state oil company Petrobras is drilling, already drilling on the Amazon equatorial margin. Okay, this is a very sensitive area, it's a sensitive ecosystem where you find coral reefs, mangroves, and it's only 500 kilometers from the Amazon River. And there have already been reports of oil spills there. So at the same time, I can't stop mentioning something else. We have Russian oil giant Rosneft, which holds rights to 12 to 14 oil and gas blocks west of the BR-319 highway. It's just 35 kilometers from the Purus River in the Solimões Basin, which is a pristine area. And this area is larger than the state of California. Okay, it's massive. So, and there's very little public scrutiny over what's happening there. And no one really wants to talk about it. So, these are some of the damaging projects and bills being pushed. And to be honest with you, if they are allowed to go ahead and if they continue this destruction, we can just wave goodbye to the Amazon as we know it.
Wow,
Wow.
that is terribly distressing and sobering to.
Yes. Do you understand that
Yeah.
the enormous implications and the large amounts of projects being, able to move forward? This should be illegal. It should be ecocide, right?
Yeah, it's all very heavy to
It
take
is
in,
heavy. Yeah.
and it's so I guess you could say it's crazy, because on the outside it sounds like, Lula has these policies for improvement at the top, but there is so much underlying issues that people are not noticing, and it's like I said, it's very heavy. And I did have a quick follow-up question to that. How much of that change is political versus, or political will versus economic pressure from agribusinesses?
Yes, to be honest with you, in my opinion, it's really a mix of both, okay? Politics and economic interests go hand in hand, and one feeds into the other, okay? So take, for instance, the reconstruction of the BR-319 highway as an example. The project is largely driven by the profits that agribusiness and big corporations expect to make from moving commodities more easily. Full stop, okay? At the same time, many regional politicians support the project and use their influence to push it forward, you know, often finding ways to justify or even bypass proper procedures. Even the president backs it, okay? So it's not just political or, you know, just economic. It's the two are closely connected and they reinforce each other.
And I wanted to also, I wanted to acknowledge what you were saying about the Indigenous people's rights being overlooked, bypassed, ignored in so many ways. Can you talk more about what Indigenous peoples are doing, how they are mobilizing? You mentioned at the top that they did put enough pressure to pause a project, but are they well organized, or can you talk more about their role and what they're doing and how they're responding to these pressures?
Yes, the indigenous, they are doing whatever they can do, but they are very limited in a decision-making process, as you can see. You know, they can't veto projects, and they should the Brazilian Constitution and by ILO Convention 169, they should be able to veto projects. But they have been misled. Okay, we have to realize that 80% of the biodiversity that remains conserved globally is located within indigenous and traditional territories. Okay, we have to realize that indigenous peoples are not the obstacle to development. They are the reason large areas of forest still exist, okay? They are nature's protectors and they should be respected as such, but they haven't been respected. Their rights continue to be violated. There are countless bribing stories, and I need to mention a couple of those, okay? I'll give you an example. There have been reports of indigenous leaders being pressured or misled. And this is by an NGO, I'm sorry to say that, into signing documents supporting the BR-319 highway project without fully understanding them. Okay? And then they were advised to take this document and send it to Brazil's environmental agency. Okay? And they realized what they're signing way after that. And this has been reported. We have the videos, we have all the documents. And this is not just a single case. Another case is a Canadian company that's investing billions of dollars in a controversial potash project to pr produce fertilizer in Autazes. Autazes is only 5 miles from the Madeira River. Okay? Thousands of the indigenous people, the Mura people, would be affected by this. The Mura have faced bribery. Countless bribery attempts by this company in the past. Okay, now this company has been given the green light to use the Madeira River, and as we know, this river is now part of the waterway privatization process that we have talked about. So these are the examples, and you know, of what's really happens in the region, and what can the indigenous people do? I mean, they're trying to do the best they can. But I can't see how they are going to win this fight.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. Yeah.
Thank you. We owe them all our gratitude for standing
We
up
do. They
to.
are our legacy, and you know, they are our protectors. And without them, I don't know what's going to happen, really.
Thank
Yes,
you.
thank you. I'm going to get into a little bit about COP30. In Brazil, which was a major moment, and after everything you've explained, it feels kind of ironic to have a COP30 in Brazil with all these underlying issues going on. My question is, how do you think Brazil handled COP30? Do you think it was a success or more of just a showpiece?
Oh my gosh.
I kind of already know the answer.
COP30 was meant to restore Brazil's credibility. They had the opportunity to do that, right? But we all know it was a disaster. Just before the summit, Brazil auctioned 172 offshore oil blocks, 47 of those were near the Amazon River. Okay. Also, we all know the final COP text avoided committing to a fossil fuel phase out. And also, there was no commitment on methane reductions either. Around one in every 25 attendees, approximately 1,600 people, were fossil fuel lobbyists. Okay. Agribusiness had a strong presence too, despite being responsible for roughly 80% of Amazon deforestation. Okay. So COP30 was also the perfect platform, the perfect opportunity to push for the development of the so-called bioeconomy, okay? Involving carbon credits, which some scientists say are built on hope and not proof. It also included biofuels, mining, and green finance, and some real dodgy financial instruments too. Think about it. If the industries driving the crisis are shaping the negotiations, can we really expect any change?
No.
No, certainly not.
Yeah, it definitely feels more of just just like a show, like a showpiece. And it seems like there wasn't much involvement with, voices from indigenous groups either.
They were protesting outside COP. They were enraged by the situation because they were not really part of the decision-making process. They weren't included. That maybe they were hurt. And this is the rhetoric. They always say, oh yes, we're gonna let them speak, we're gonna hear them, but they are not part of the decision-making process, which they should be. And they're not allowed to say no to projects. It's just
Yeah.
upset.
I attended a talk once by she was an indigenous leader from Brazil, and she was an activist too, and she kept talking about how there's no indigenous voices in the rooms where they make decisions. And that was a big part of her talk, and I just remember thinking about that, and it's just so wild because the indigenous groups are living in the Amazon. They're taking care of the Amazon. Why are they not part of these, decision-making groups? It's just,
But the situation is so complex, it's so complex, and there are so many organizations and institutions interested in exploiting nature and using these communities as a front. I mean, it's a web of corruption, and I've been digging into it. I have a major investigation that I'm trying to continue to work on, and it's ugly. It's very ugly.
And then just another quick follow-up question. Do you think that COP30 moved the needle at all for the Amazon region?
Not at all,
No.
not one bit. No, it's all about development, it's all about profit and power. In reality, none of the decision makers had nature and the indigenous and traditional communities at the top or any part of their agenda. Full stop.
Oh, that's so sad.
That is sad. Monica, you've shared very well the place of, President Lula and the agribusiness and interests and all of these extractive industries. What are there, and then of course the indigenous people trying hard to stop this destruction. Politically, are there other groups in addition to the indigenous communities that have a voice, that are pushing back against those powers? And what does that look like? What is the this, whose other voices are being heard in this area, if any?
They're pretty much on the same level because they have no power. I mean, you have riverside communities. I wrote a piece about the Belo Monte Dam, right? It's hydro. So basically, the riverside communities were displaced. They were threatened, and it's just chaotic. It's catastrophic too. because they have no power to and they try through legal systems, which also are slow and not exactly perfect route to sort all these problems. So they end up giving up, to be honest with you, and they shouldn't, but they have no force, no power.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
You've written for independent media and international outlets. How does reporting on environmental issues in Brazil compare with reporting from Europe or the US?
Right. Reporting in Brazil is complex, okay? Access to data is harder. Freedom of information processes are quite slow, confusing, and very weak. There's a real issue about transparency, availability, and also accuracy of data, and they are less open to scrutiny too. So, for you to have an idea, some media outlets are even funded or owned by politicians. So, you see how this process can be challenging as well. I forgot to mention something that is worth talking about, okay? It's Brazil's economic model, okay? That's basically based on exporting raw commodities, okay? So economic growth is equated, with extraction, literally. So deforestation may have declined in official statistics, like some of the news outlets have been reporting it, but let's we have to be honest, it hasn't reached 0%, which is what we need, okay? And degradation has increased significantly, so corruption in the country also remains systemic too, and this is really important to mention. In the past year alone, Brazil saw a pension fund fraud diverting over $1.1 billion, and recently a banking scandal affecting 800,000 investors with more than 7 billion in dollars in debt. Okay, so you see, when governance is weak, environmental protection will suffer. Okay, I would like to point out that it's also in other nations' interest. On the other hand, the rich nations, the ones exploiting and also benefiting from Brazil's nature, that the country remains in debt, okay? And that there's no technology transfer. So that will keep Brazil dependent and undeveloped. I think this is really important to say as well, because we have to balance and realize whose fault it is. We're all complicit.
That was a very critical point that you made, and I did just want to briefly go back with reporting environmental issues in Brazil. It must take a lot of courage because it seems like investigative journalism has real personal consequences. So I wanted to ask, what keeps you motivated to keep telling these stories?
Yes, it has been challenging. It's a very lonely world when you work solo, and at the same time, there are some certain subjects that are very sensitive. During the time when I was reporting on the BR-319, there were so many attempts to stop me from doing so. I had my phone and my computer hacked, for instance. And you can tell one of the news outlets I was that was publishing my stories even reported that they tried to hack them, and the IP address came from Brazil. So we can't prove anything, but we it's challenging. But one of the main things that keeps me going is a strong sense of justice. Okay, I really believe that what's happening around us isn't fair, and we can't keep silent. Okay, our future really depends on the survival of the Amazon, and people don't understand the enormity of this. Nature and vulnerable communities have been left to fend for themselves, and you've seen what I've just mentioned to you. The people in power and the systems that are supposed to protect these people and all of us, they simply aren't doing their job. Okay. I really feel for the future of our children and for the next generation. So this is a big part of why I keep telling these stories. Yeah.
Well, thank
Thank
you. Thanks for using your talents to speak for all of those who don't have the power and the platform to do that. And it is sad that our large systems are failing us collectively, globally, because as you noted, it is a collective problem. We all are complicit. We all have to be part of the solution wherever we live. And so I really thank you for your courage, for putting yourself out there, for telling the hard stories, for dealing with the threats and so forth.
I get very emotional, you know, because I can see how important the region is. Sorry, I can see how it is important, and I can see those communities, how much they struggle, and they have no protection whatsoever. And I can see the greed, and you know, these people are greedy, and they are, you know, in search for power, and they don't realize that their own kids will be suffering. You know, and this is a very crucial moment. We have to understand, and we have to spread the word so people understand the implications of this. Yeah, thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. I wanted to ask too about the information, the media system. So many people get their news, environmental news, any kind of news through social media now. Do you think that helps or hurts public understanding of what's really happening in the Amazon or the media ecosystem in general?
That's a very good question. Yes, social media is a double-edged sword. It can be a toxic place, spreading lies, you know, misinformation very quickly as well. We all know this. But on the other hand, it also connects people who genuinely want to see change. So the problem is nowadays, another problem I see is that people now expect instant gratification. Okay. They don't take time to read an article. You know, but you see, complex environmental crisis cannot be understood through short posts. Okay. So people can't make good decisions based on two short, you know, short sentences from Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok. You know, what we have to realize is that what happens in the Amazon and in the Cerrado will affect global climate systems. Yet many people in Brazil and internationally have little understanding of what's happening. Okay, so basically, social media does help to spread the word, but it doesn't give you the full picture. Yeah.
That's a very good point. Yes. Sound bites don't do justice to the incredibly complex systems and problems and that you've illustrated in our discussion today. It takes time to delve in. So thank you for doing that with us today.
Thank you.
When you look ahead, at the Amazon, at Brazil, or at our planet, what gives you hope right now?
Right. To be honest, the scale of destruction we've been witnessing, not just in Brazil, but also across the world, makes hope very difficult. The number of extraction and infrastructure projects and absurd bills moving forward suggests that short-term profit still dominates the decision-making. Okay? But I still do. We need hope in order to survive. That's we're humans. So I do have hope. I have hope in people like in the indigenous and traditional communities who continue to protect their land and nature. I have hope in family farmers who feed us. Okay. I have hope in scientists who have the courage and aren't afraid of speaking out. And I have hope in the younger generations demanding accountability. But one thing is clear, we must prepare for a more chaotic world. I am not a doomer. Please don't confuse me for a doomer, but we have to be realistic. Okay. But all I can see at the moment is a state of paralysis coming from our global leaders. So we need to start to adapt fast. We must have a plan to deal with all the chaos about to hit us all. Climate change will intensify migration, will increase food security, health crisis and conflicts. We are already seeing, early signs of it. So if we fail to address climate change and inequality together, okay, the situation will spiral out of control. So.
Exactly. Yeah, everything is connected, so it could just cause a domino effect. And also when it comes to, like, obviously we know we're in the US and our administration decided to undo years of, climate action. And so it's just like everything's kind of, going backwards when we should be moving forward and taking climate action. But yeah, I'm kind of on the same page as you. Like I still try to have hope, but it is a little hard to have hope in
Yes.
this day and age.
And it plays out with your, people's mental status, mental health. People stop, like I have to be really careful, because I have lost sleep over it. You really have to balance, it all and make sure that you're mentally there,
Yeah,
healthy. Right?
exactly.
That's right. Yes, I think taking action, as you're doing in your writing, and what we all need to be finding ways to take meaningful action. And like you said, if our systems aren't supporting it, then we need to be doing it at the grassroots level and coming together in our communities, local environments to push things forward and help people see the scale of the problem. And so I think, and I like you said, without hope, it does lead to paralysis. So we do have to keep hope and we have to keep acting and pushing the way forward. So thank you
Absolutely.
for your part in that. And I would just like to finish with asking you, what are you working on next? What projects or stories should we be watching for from you in the near term?
Sure. I've just finished an article into Brazil's emerging water crisis. Okay, how forests regulate rainfall and sustain agriculture in cities across South America, and how deforestation, degradation, and climate change threatens that system. I'm actually going to publish it tomorrow, and I'm also I'm also working on a 5,000 word project, and also I continue to carry on with my larger investigation. So yes, I can't discuss this right now.
Of course, understood. And all the best of luck on that investigation and your
Thank you.
safety and success in exposing what needs to be told.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Monica, thank you. I think we'll end there. I want to thank you so much for bringing us closer to the Amazon, for reminding us why storytelling matters in climate work. We really appreciate you.
Yes, thank you. And I hope I was clear enough.
Very clear. Thank you. You gave a very comprehensive, sobering look at what's happening in Brazil and worldwide, how it affects us all.
Okay, thank you so much.
Listeners, you can find Monica's articles on Medium and Substack. We'll link her work in the show notes.
If you enjoyed the episode, follow the MIR podcast and share it with someone who cares about the future of the Amazon. You can find resources at MIR.org and updates on X at MIR SRM.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.